I see some more people joining. Just want to welcome you to the call. This is call number 3 of the March module, the Living Beyond Complexity course, and we'll go ahead and get started here in just 1 or 2 more minutes. And in the meantime, everyone's on mute just to ensure the quality of the recording. So thanks for joining us, and we'll get started shortly.
Hello.
Hey, is that Mark?
Yes, it is, sir.
Mark, how are you doing?
I am well, thank you.
Great. So we have a bunch of people on the line, and I've made a couple of announcements. Everyone's on mute. I think we're ready to get started, if you are.
I am completely ready, Clint, and delighted to be here with you and with Zach and Nicole. And I apologize. It took me a couple of minutes to get into the line. I didn't quite get in immediately, so I had to dial a couple of times. So thank you all for waiting patiently. And for those of you who are downloading, which I think is most of the people, you didn't have to wait, so I take the apology back. Okay, so here we go, everybody. It's delightful to be with you and to be in this second simplicity framework at the end of this month. And I know that it must be, I think, 60, 70 people participated in calls with Zach and with Clint and with Nicole. And I just got just incredible feedback from them, that each one of them was just so kind of productive and deep and, you know, just a world onto themselves. So just to say something, you know, as we begin, just about the wonder of this format, you know, to kind of recapitulate for a second. So in our first week, and this is an entirely new, you know, really leading edge integral format, and we're calibrating as we go. We're in the kind of great integral laboratory. So for this month, what we did is we did an initial call, which I did a kind of Dharma talk about second simplicity and what we mean by that. Then there was some weaving by Zach and by Clint, giving a little bit of a kind of a integral theoretical pointers, just what we might want to think about as we engage this conversation. That was kind of part one. Then there were 3 breakout calls, you know, a kind of more philosophical bent, you know, with Zach, a kind of theory bent with Clint, a very kind of practical coaching bent with Nicole, which really worked this idea of second simplicity. So we tried to kind of bring it and integrate it in those 3 ways. And now we're coming back in the 3rd week, and it's a 3-week cycle, to now see how would we apply this framework of second simplicity right to life. We're going to kind of return to kind of a big view, you know, a meta picture, kind of a large story view, and try and see how would we, you know, how do we apply this to life? How does this actually play out? And most important, why is this so unbelievably important? You know, and in some deep sense, the question that we're going to be answering today is, why is this so important? Why is second simplicity so critical? So that's where we are. So I hope that's kind of gives everyone a kind of orienting framework. That's number one. Number two, and before we begin, or we've actually already begun, but in the midst of our beginning, number two is, you know, we talked about a year ago when I was teaching with, you know, my dear brother Clint at the pre-day of an iEvolve event that we did with Clint and myself and Mariana, Nicole, Ken in Denver. You know, I talked about the idea that theory is love. And Clint and I did actually a couple of dialogues on this, which I believe were sent out to Core Integral, you know, in that beautiful Core Integral framework. You know, and theory as love is a very, very important idea. You know, there's this kind of new age preference for experience. Now, we all love experience. Experience is fantastic. Experience is the first person, and sometimes experience is also the second person. Right? There's a second person experiential or inner subjective. Two subjects exchange and meet, and there's deep contact, and those are critical faces of the divine. And then there's a third face of the divine, and I think Clint, you specifically spoke about this in your call, in your breakout call. There's a third face of the divine, which is the story, the narrative, the picture, the theory, the map, right? We call that, you know, in Hebrew mysticism, the Torah, or we call it in Buddhism, the Dharma, right? It's the teaching, it's the sutra, right? In an older, you know, Hindu format, and it's the sutra, it's the teaching, right? And the reason that's so important to reclaim that is because it's gotten lost, right? In the New Age world, if you don't, you know, immediately within 3 minutes go to an experience, well, then who's going to come back? I mean, we just want to have our experience. right? We, you know, give me my hit, right? Give me my experience, which is all well and good because experiences are beautiful, but they're just one piece of the story. And not only are they just one piece of the story, not only is experience only one out of three perspectives, particularly first person, sometimes, of course, also second person, but what's critical is that the experience is always interpreted through what Charles Taylor calls in his book Sources of Self. In the beginning, he calls it inescapable frameworks. It's a fantastic phrase, right? Inescapable frameworks. And I'm always kind of chatting with my friends, Zach and Clint and Nicole. So Zach, this is more your kind of book, right? Sources of Self. Clint, I don't know if you ever, you know, ran across that book. It's one of the most awesome books.
Well, I ran across it, Mark, but only because Zach recommended it.
Oh, okay. So Sources of Self is, yeah. You know, Zach and I are both in the same crazy reading list. That's what we share in common, in insanity for books of this nature. But this book is awesome, right? It's one of just the great books ever written. And, you know, Charles Taylor is just one of the, you know, just the fantastic writers. So he talks about in the very beginning inescapable frameworks. What he means by that is that there's no way that you cannot have a framework of interpretation. So whatever happens to you gets interpreted, right? Every experience gets interpreted through a framework of meaning, of values, of orientation, through the story, the narrative, right, which is your organized view of reality, right, which sometimes is conscious, other times is unconscious. So if you don't have an orienting framework, right, and you don't make that conscious, then you're basically being driven either by an unconscious framework, right, or by a framework that, you know, could very, very possibly be wrong, but you don't even know that you're using it. It's hugely problematic. And if you can't just have experience, you need a framework, a story, a prism through which you interpret your framework, and you need that to be the best story that you have, the best framework, the most advanced moral framework, the most advanced epistemological framework, the most advanced psychological framework, the most advanced spiritual framework, the most advanced, you know, kind of real political framework, right? You need to actually know what's the narrative, what's your vision of values and meaning to which you interpret things. Because without that, right, you just have nothing, you don't know what to do with your experience. So that's really, really important. So in this course, right, in Second Simplicity, what we're interested in doing is reclaiming that framework, or reclaiming what we called the first week, the story, right, the meta-narrative. The meta-narrative is enormously humble, right? It acknowledges lots of uncertainty, but it also claims its certainties, right? It also is aware of what it knows, right? It's also aware that there's a second simplicity. There's things that we know that guide us in the world, and those are the orienting generalizations, to borrow Ken's phrase, through which we guide our lives, through which we make our ethical decisions, our relationship decisions, our love decisions, right, and through which we transmit values, right, to our children and grandchildren, whether those are biological children or grandchildren or the next generation that we affect through our work in the world. So that's what this course is about. This course is about let's actually build together a framework through which we can live our lives. Now, the integral framework, right, is basically a set of tools or of pointing out instructions in first, second, and third person, right, which help you create the story. They help you create the most advanced story that you could create today on the planet. Right? You use the integral framework to actually create, you know, the integral framework is a kind of a set of discerning tools that help you create the most advanced story. So, for example, you know, you might want to be able to distinguish between pre-rational and trans-rational. So if you're in a drumming circle, you know, at Burning Man, you know, are you engaged in an ecstatic, beautiful experience, and whatever you experience there, you should experience as a great vision to guide your life? Maybe. That could be true. But you just want to figure out, well, is that drumming circle where you're feeling total ecstasy, is that pre-personal or trans-personal? So that distinction between pre and trans, right, is a distinction offered, you know, by lots of, you know, really important thinkers that we've placed front and center in the integral framework. So that pre-trans distinction, that's a discerning instruction that helps you interpret your experience in order to, right, guide your life. That's a perfect example, right? So you're involved in deep ecstatic, right, ecstatic prayer, right? Is that good or bad? Well, it depends. Are you in a cult, which is pre-personal? So that ecstatic prayer involves a regression because you've given up your autonomy, which is personal. Or are you in an authentic, wholesome spiritual community? It's transpersonal, which means it transcends and includes the personal. So therefore, it includes your personal autonomy, your personal integrity, right? And you're able to give up your small self to merge with a larger community without giving up your kind of sense of personhood and integrity. But that's a critical distinction. So in other words, the fact that I'm having a great experience of ecstasy, that by itself is just what it is. It's an experience. How do I interpret that experience? Is it pre-personal or transpersonal? That's a discerning instruction, right, that the integral framework, this distinction will give you. So that's just to give you an example of what we mean by this, right? I need an orienting story, right? And then I need discerning instructions to actually interpret, right, what's actually happening in my life and to understand, right, how it actually, right, lines up as part of this larger story. So all of this is just kind of by way of introduction, right? This is what we're doing in Second Simplicity. That's what this whole course is going to be about. We're going to talk about kindness, you know, and laughter and ethical mindfulness and relationships and sexuality, right? And all the things that are actually essential to our lives, right? How, and we're going to expand, right, deepen the texture of the integral framework, right, by addressing all these areas that actually don't get talked about a lot, right? Because the purpose of integral is to provide a framework. But we now have to fill in the framework, right? How do we actually engage kindness, right? How many times do you hear people talking about kindness, right, in an integral discussion? What do you mean? We're talking about theory. No, theory is a framework for more love. It's a framework for how I can be a kinder person. It's a framework, right, for how I can be a more passionate and creative person, right? It's a, but that creativity, that passion, that kindness, that love is expanded when I actually am living in a framework, a context of meaning, a moral context, a spiritual context. It's that, that's what this is all about. Second Simplicity is about a reconstructive project. It's a reconstructive project which allows us, right, to reclaim, right, not at a level of fundamentalism, not at a level of, you know, the dogmatism, right, which kind of marked much of the great traditions, but a kind of post-great traditions. We transcend and include the great traditions, right? We use the integral framework to recreate, to reconstruct, right, core frameworks of meaning, right, that can guide us, right, and guide the future generations. So it's a leading edge project, a reconstructive project, right, to create the second simplicities, not the fundamentalist simplicities, right, to actually go beyond complexity to the second simplicity. Okay, so that's, you know, I spend now about, let me check the time, right, about 12 minutes on that. Okay, so that was just a kind of, you know, orienting introduction, right, to Second Simplicity to deepen what we said week one and to really help you understand, right, why we're doing this course, you know, and why you might actually want to be with us, right, in the next 7-8 months to really benefit from this interdisciplinary conversation between myself and Zach and Nicole, right, as we actually bring online together and, you know, this deep, inescapable framework of our lives at this level, this new level of consciousness, right, this level of second simplicity. Okay. So now, we'll breathe for a second. And now let's apply the second simplicity model. I want to apply everything we just said, which is all kind of these meta comments. I want to apply it to life. Why is this so necessary? So what I want to talk about in the next few minutes, and we're going to kind of offer a real powerful application of second simplicity and how it plays in your life and in my life for a certain period of time, then we're going to stop and, you know, ask, you know, the people on the phone. I know that, you know, the overwhelming majority of people are on web downloads, so on a web download it's hard to ask a question, but we'll offer at least the people on the phone the opportunity to ask some questions and, you know, to hear kind of whatever kind of commentary and exchange we have between us on this call in this kind of living integral conversation. Here's the application. So now we're in part two. We do the introduction, the meta frame, now the application, part two. The application is Japan, my friends. Japan. Oh, my God. I mean, we've all followed the news. I mean, you can't even just begin to describe horrific, right? You know, I was watching on Sunday night as I came back from a vacation with Mariana and Zion. Zion's my little 6-month-old son. And we were watching the news, and we were arguing about some little detail of life that people argue about. And then we just got kind of shame-faced with embarrassment as we kind of see the news come on, and this mother is describing, you know, how the tsunami ripped her daughter from her hands. And like, oh, my God, you just fall apart. You know, I mean, 10,000 people killed. I mean, just, you know, just and the horror of it and the way it happened. Like, what do you do with that? Now, if approaching this isn't part of our lives, then we live poor lives indeed. Right? And if a framework of integral thinking can't address, right, how we grapple with something like Japan, well, then the framework's not too helpful. Right? How in our real lives do we actually open ourselves up to this horror without getting destroyed by it, without getting absorbed by it, without getting paralyzed by it? And so I want to try and walk you through the three levels of consciousness that we described in the first week. Right? First, simplicity; complexity; second, simplicity. Those are the three levels. And we gave a couple of applications to them. Story, right? There's a narrative, a meta-narrative story, then no story, right? The meta-narrative is undermined, it's destroyed, and then after it's destroyed, a new story comes back online, a higher story, right? The story of second simplicity. So simplicity, complexity, second simplicity, level 1, 2, and 3. Story, the destoring, level 2, no story, then level 3, a higher reconstructed story. So how does this apply to life? So Japan, let's see how it applies to Japan. So what would the first simplicity response be to Japan? Okay? And I would love actually to hear everyone's response. I don't think we're technologically set up for that at this moment. Right? But just think about it. Right? Think about it. Right? What would a first simplicity response be to Japan? Right? To this terrible human tragedy. Right? Level one. Right? What's level one? Remember, simplicity or story. Or we offered in the first week, 2 weeks ago, certainty. Right? Certainty, simplicity, story. Right? What would the story be? So the story would be what's classically called, right, in philosophy, theodicy. Theodicy. Theodicy means, how do you explain suffering? More particularly, stay with me. Right, it means, how do you as a spiritual human being, right, who believes that the world is good and that the divine force that animates the world and that guides the world is good, how do you explain then the evil or the apparent evil of suffering? That involvement, that search is called theodicy. Why do bad things, seemingly bad things, really bad things, happen to seemingly really good people? But why do bad things happen to good people? And my colleague Harold Kushner, right, wrote a book by that title some 20 years back, which sold, you know, like tens of millions of copies in America, because everyone said, like, oh my God, this is the question, right? If we're talking about kindness and goodness, but the world operates with tsunamis that wipe people out, when the world doesn't look very kind and very good. And if the world is a reflection either of a personal God or of a love intelligence, right, that guides and animates the cosmos, well, then why is there so much evil, right? I mean, how do you recite psalms of praise, right, in the face of burning children, right, in Rwanda? Now, what does that mean? I mean, does everyone understand? I mean, it's like the question is beyond. And the question is huge, right? And so that question, right, the great question of human suffering and of evil, right, that is the great question. And so the first way that it's been responded to in a very sophisticated way, right, for basically, you know, 1,800, 1,900 years at least in the classical traditions, but really more, really 3,000, 4,000 years, right, is through explanations of suffering. And these explanations, as sophisticated as they are, they're still at the level of simplicity. They're still level one. Why? Okay, now here we go. Okay, we're going to do this big kind of leap of understanding here. It's going to be very, very clear and really kind of open your mind, open your heart. It's simple, but you got to follow it. You see, what are the basic explanations given for suffering? Right, the basic explanations are, in one way or the other, that this suffering was intentionally caused by the universe for a series of reasons which we can actually understand. So, for example, one explanation is called the soul making theodicy. Right? Through this great suffering, your soul is improved, your soul evolves, you become a deeper and better person. So So actually, although it looks like suffering, really on the inside of it, it's really this great gift from God. And the analogy used by many of the modern teachers of this soul-making theodicy, but this is the soul-making theodicy is several thousand years old, but the modern teachers, the way they usually explain it is, you know, if you look at an operating table, and you see on the operating table there's a person laying on the table, and then you see, oh my God, the doctor's taking a knife and cutting the person open, right? Oh my God, they're killing the person. But then you realize, no, they're not killing the person, they're actually performing surgery. They're actually saving the person's life. So that's soul-making theodicy. Soul-making theodicy says it looks like it's bad, but really it's not. If you really knew what was going on, you would realize that this is really for the greater good of the person. That's one example of a theodicy. Another example, you know, might be, a second example, well, the people that you think are good, that are suffering, really aren't good, right? They have some hidden evil, either in this life, you know, or in a previous life. But don't think they're so good. If you really had all the information necessary, you would realize they weren't good and they were actually getting their just punishment. This is actually some form of punishment, right? Or, you know, a third version, right, of a classical theodicy, which Thornton Wilder describes in his book Bridge Over St. Louis Ray, in which five people, you know, fall down to their deaths on a kind of rickety bridge, you know, traversing a kind of mountain pass, and a religious kind of priest watches this happen, and he's devastated by how God could allow these good people, right, to die in this way. So he begins to look into the story of each one of them, and somehow it emerges that it was actually perfect, that this ending was exactly necessary and perfect for each one of the five people, right, based on their story. And people call that the tapestry image theodicy. And what they mean by that is if you look underneath a tapestry, you remember when your mother is sewing a tapestry, underneath you see all the threads hanging out, it looks like a mess. So we're underneath the tapestry. But if you look above the tapestry, you see how it's a beautiful, organized, coherent picture. So these are all forms of theodicy. Now, are they wrong? Well, they're not wrong. They're partial, right? They each touch something which has truth, but they're insufficient, right? You know, is it true that we don't know everything? Of course it is. Is it true that in a larger meta picture, things might well make sense that don't make sense to us from our narrow perspective? Of course it's true. Is it true that a person can deepen through suffering? Obviously true. But those are still insufficient. We still view them as simplicity. And we view them as simplicity because it's an attempt through the answer to simply remove the question. There was a question. The question was, oh my God, how can people suffer? And then there's an answer. And the answer is simple in that the answer removes the question. Right? Now that we have the answer, there's no longer a challenge to God's goodness. There's no longer, right, a question. There's no longer a raging, you know, burning existential angst and pain ripping my heart apart because now I understand. This was for the person's betterment. This is because the person who looks like they're good really isn't good, right? This is, right, because in a different incarnation, right, we needed to work out, right, what went wrong, right? So it's being corrected in this incarnation. These are all forms of clear-cut theological explanations that explain away the problem of suffering. Now, again, let me say it again, right? This is true. These explanations might be true, but they're partial. They're insufficient. What I mean by insufficient is that actually no theodicy, no explanation for suffering, right, can explain away the horror of the Holocaust, right, of people burning, right, in gas chambers, right? No explanation, right, can explain away, right, 100,000 people, right, you know, I mean, you know, completely, you know, brutally murdered in the first 10 days of the Rwandan massacres, went up to 800,000, right, by the time the 100-day massacre was over, right? No amount of explanation can remove, no answer can remove the question, okay? So that's already the rejection of the first simplicity. We say that we actually don't accept these answers for suffering. And because these answers for suffering are too simple, right? They're answers which say, right, we're now going to remove the question. The question doesn't exist. We've answered the question. That doesn't work for us. And so what we do is we go to the next level of consciousness. And this next level of consciousness is the rejection of the first simplicity, right? We get lost in the complexity, and sometimes we just have no answer. We just don't know what to do, And I'll give you an example of a voice like this. If you read Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky, right? It's an awesome book. An awesome, awesome book, right? And you see that Ivan talks to, right, to Alyosha, right? One of his children, right, who's a priest. And Ivan says to Alyosha, right, after describing this horrific scene, right, in which a general, right, who's this brutal general, right, who has these hounds, right? Then there's a child, right? And Ivan says to his brother Alyosha, and he says to his brother Alyosha, not his son, his brother, right? He says, you know, let me describe to you what happened, right? There was this boy, and this boy threw a pebble at a hound, right? And then the general had everybody gather in the town and brought all of the, you know, hounds together and brought the mother of the boy and told the boy to run. And the boy had to run and then sicked all of the hounds on the boy as they ripped the boy apart as he made his mother watch. Oh, my God. And Ivan says to Alyosha, right, to his brother, he says, I don't want to hear your explanation of why this is theologically justifiable. I don't want to hear your theodicy, is essentially what he says. He says, I don't want to be there, right, you know, in the resurrection when Jesus and the general and the boy and the mother all join together, right, in tearful embrace, realizing the justice of God and why this needed to be. You understand? And it's what Ivan's doing, right, through the voice of Dostoevsky, what Dostoevsky's doing through the voice of Ivan is saying, I'm rejecting the first simplicity, right? I'm rejecting, the, you know, in this case, the classical theodicies, right, the explanations of suffering. They don't hold, right? The pain is so intense, I'd rather be lost in the complexity of not knowing. I'd rather, right, you know, reject any possible answer, right, than accept the obscenity, right, of the simplicity, right, of the classical theodicies. Well, that's it. That's the second level of consciousness. And in some real sense, Dostoevsky is reflecting a modern, right, a modern zeitgeist, right, in which the classical theodicies of the great traditions were rejected. Now, this is very, very significant, okay? So let's just drop in this together really gently because we're trying to understand how do we deal with Japan and how do we explain Japan. So the first simplicity is, right, we give for Japan, you know, any one of the explanations of suffering. And let me be really clear, dear friends, this is a critical, critical point to understand in our discerning. It's not just the great traditions, the religions who offer the classical theodicies, right? The New Age movement does the exact same thing. New Age movement and classical traditions both do the same thing. They both say, right, we can explain why people suffer. And the New Age movement will give its explanations and say, you know, you created this reality. Nothing happens to you. No reality is created that you didn't create yourself, right? And why is the New Age movement doing it? Well, for the same reason the great traditions are, in order to maintain power. You follow? In other words, if terrible things happen to people and it's not a result of some form of sin, some form of something we've done wrong in this life or a past life, well, then the world is incomprehensible. We've lost all power. But if we say, well, if we use a classical theodicy and say, well, this is happening because God's actually making us deeper, or this is happening because, you know, we've sinned, then we can at least retain power. We retain power because, right, either there's a good God that's taking care of us, or it was our sin that caused it, so if we correct the sin, it won't happen. Same thing with the New Age, right? The New Age, which refuses to recognize, you know, mystery, right, kind of tries to apply all a whole set of kind of what I would call kind of the kind of New Age cosmic laws, right? You go to Avatar, one of the largest New Age movements. You go to the Landmark Forum, right? All expressions of the New Age, right? They'll explain to you that any suffering that's happening in your life, you created it, right? You created it. It's not real, right? It's in your mind. But if you would readjust your mind, it wouldn't be there anymore. By the way, a classical expression of this is Byron Katie, who's a dear woman, and I had a long conversation with her about this, and she's a fantastic person and done a lot of good. And her basic teaching is, right, that actually there is no real suffering, right? That there is no real suffering, right? It's all about you having a wrong mindset, and your wrong mindset is what creates the suffering, but if you would shift your mindset, there wouldn't be suffering. I did a dialogue with her. It actually appears on my website where we kind of went, you know, head-to-head with this. And I tried to explain to her that, no, actually, It doesn't work this way. If you look at it from an integral perspective, you actually have to understand that not everything's created in your mind. That's just the upper left quadrant. But there's all these other quadrants that are at play, right, that can actually create suffering, which are not controlled by the upper left quadrant. And when one quadrant controls the other quadrants, right, Ken very beautifully refers to that as quadrant absolutism. So this is a real issue we're dealing with here. Okay, so we've got first simplicity, we explain suffering. And first simplicity can be expressed by the great religions, the great traditions, or it can be expressed by the New Age movement. But either way, it's we have explanations for suffering. We know the laws of the universe. This is why suffering happens. Are those laws all wrong? No. Are those explanations all wrong? No. They're true but partial. They have a partial insight, but they don't exhaust the full pain and horror of suffering. Okay? So what we need is we need to move beyond the first simplicity. That's what Dostoevsky has Ivan do when he rejects the classical theodicies of Christianity, right? And where do we get to? So we get to complexity, right? It's level two. And complexity can lead to lots of things. It can lead to skepticism. It can also lead to a loss, right? A loss of an ability to access an organized universe, a good universe, a universe in which there's personal caring, right? Because the brutality of it all leads one to believe, which is exactly where Sartre went to and where Camus went to, right? And where, you know, lots of the kind of French existentialists in the 30s and 40s went, which is the world is ultimately meaningless, right? Read, you know, a great book called by William Barrett, published in 1958, called Irrational Man. Right? It's the best summation of the kind of Gaia Cometti sculpture meaninglessness, right, of the world, which was affirmed by the existentialists in response or in rejection of the first simplicity classical theodicies, right, of the great traditions. So one response, you know, one characteristic, if you will, of this second level of consciousness beyond first simplicity, this place of complexity, is a kind of, we kind of lose the personal, caring, loving quality of the universe, which is precisely desperation of the existential level of consciousness. And this existential desperation, right, is the flip side of what Ken calls centaur consciousness. For those of you who really, really know integral theory, if you don't, just completely skip that line, not important. But when Ken describes centaur consciousness, right, the flip side of centaur consciousness, which is the very, very edge, the highest edge of personal development, right, before one kind of makes the leap into the transpersonal, right, one experiences also this incredible sense of pain at the meaninglessness of it all, right, that the kind of undergirding frames and frameworks, right, have been undermined, right, the story has been destroyed. So that's you know, when we're talking about suffering, when we reject the classical theodicies, you know, and we get to the second level of consciousness, right, the consciousness of complexity, of uncertainty. We've left the certainty behind. We're now in complete uncertainty. We have no idea, right? You know, that's a whole other level of consciousness. We've left story behind. We're now in the destroyed world. There is no organizing narrative which explains how Japan could possibly happen. That's the second level of consciousness. Okay, and so now we get to the third level. And the third level is second simplicity. Okay, now why is the third level so important? Now, kind of let's just stay with this. We're just going to go 5 more minutes. Then we're going to open up for conversation and questions. But we're really trying to stay with this deeply. Okay, we're trying to be very, very organized here. We're doing this very, very deep, you know, entry into perhaps the greatest problem that a human being faces on this planet, which is, how do I actually act constructively as a constructive force for healing and transformation and in the face of horrific evil? And how can I even possibly believe that there's actually a love intelligence and organizing structure, right, a trajectory of goodness, right, that actually undergirds and inheres and animates the universe? And this question is so burning for any person whose heart is open. I spend a decade of my life just thinking about this day and night. And at some point when I was like 32, 33, I stopped everything I was doing to write a several hundred page book in Hebrew to try and explain this to myself. That's the only reason you ever really write a book, to explain something to yourself. It's a big deal, this question, right? Not to realize that this question is like the biggest deal in the world is to be dead. It means your heart is closed. while your heart is egocentric, right? It's only open to yourself and your immediate circle, right? Or you're ethnocentric. You're only affected by suffering. It affects, you know, your particular, right, your particular communal orientation. But if you're really alive, if you're really at world-centric consciousness, or even at, you know, a higher, at cosmocentric consciousness, where you're identified not only with the suffering of human beings, but the suffering of all sentient beings through generations, right? If you have any sort of world-centric or cosmocentric consciousness, which I think everyone on this phone call probably does, then your heart's ripped open by the problem of suffering. All right, and this framework that we're offering, we're about to finish in the next 5 minutes, right, is the biggest gift we could possibly give you, because you can't live as a cosmocentric person or as a world-centric person without engaging and grappling with this, right, in the very, very heart of your being. Right, this is everything. Okay, so let's try and understand it. So how do we work? How do we get to level three? How do we get to second simplicity? How do we get to a reconstructed story beyond the destoring, right, of meaning, which is caused by radical suffering, which is caused by gas chambers? Right? How do we actually reclaim meaning in the face of gas chambers, in the face of Japan? And one's man-made evil, gas chambers. The other is ostensibly natural evil, right, which is tsunami, but both cause enormous suffering. How do we work with that? How do we work with that? So in order to kind of offer an approach to it, let me just deepen the question one level, okay? What's the problem, right? Why is suffering so problematic? Because how can I relate, right, to a personal God, or, right, to a love intelligence, right, that cares, right, in the face of such apparent radical uncaring? That's the question. That's the problem. That's the huge, you know, ripping, searing, you know, kind of conundrum, you know, violent, you know, kind of demanding, you know, koan of suffering. And so what the third level, what second simplicity says is that actually any theology that deadens your sensitivity to pain is not kosher, right? It's obscene. And that what we need to do at the level of second simplicity is not to answer the question, but to actually cry out the question. When we cry out and say, why? Why is there suffering? Right? How could it be, right, that the love intelligence of all that is, that I access, right, in interpersonal relationships, that I access, right, as the motivating force of the cosmos, which moves us to higher and higher levels, right, at every stage of evolution of recognition, mutuality, union, and embrace. How could it be that the love that I access in deep meditation and in prayer, how could that love intelligence, those two qualities together, love and intelligence, how could that those qualities allow for suffering? And I actually turn that question, right, to the love intelligence itself. And I say, how could this be? Right? And in some frameworks, right, I turn, right, to actually the personal face, what we call an integral, the second face of God. We say, God, right, how could you allow this to happen? Or as Abraham says in the old biblical story, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, will the judge of the entire universe, right, not do justice? Right? It's the question's hurled at God. Right? When I hurl that question at God, what I'm actually doing, or at God, or at the love intelligence that animates all that is with its personal face, when I actually hurl that question, right, it's the question itself which is the answer. And it's not that there's an answer to the question disappears. But the very fact that I'm horrified at evil, that itself is God in me being horrified. Right? The very fact that I refuse to accept a world, right, of gas chambers, right? The very fact that I'm horrified at the injustice and the terror of a tsunami, right? That voice itself is the God voice, right? And it's that voice itself is divinity calling out and saying, this can't be, this is wrong. And so when I actually call out and say, judge of the whole world, how could you not do justice? The voice of Abraham in the ancient mystical text, that's actually, Abraham is incarnating the voice of God. And it's by asking the question, I'm actually engaged intimately with spirit. Because if the world is, stay with me, if the world is flatland, If the world is, as Lewis Mumford says, disqualified, if there's no depth to the cosmos, if there's no spirit to the cosmos, right? If the world does not adhere, right, with love intelligence, right, it's a mere dead matter flatland, well, then there's no reason to ask, why do people suffer? Of course people suffer. Why wouldn't people suffer? Right? The word suffering doesn't even make sense. Right? And it's the only way that the outrage at injustice makes sense if there's an implicit understanding deep in our consciousness that the world should be just, and that human dignity and adequacy should be affirmed, and lives shouldn't be cut short, and torture is a violation of homo imago Dei, or of spirit that lives as man. Right? In other words, our very outrage at injustice, the outrage itself, right, the hurling of the question itself is the answer. That's second simplicity. It's a very simple understanding. The simple understanding is, right, my outrage and injustice itself, the great question of why people suffer, that question itself is the answer. It's a simple recognition. It's a simple recognition, right, that, wow, I affirm the dignity of my outrage. I affirm the knowing that that lives deep within me, right, that babies, right, shouldn't be ripped apart in front of their mothers. Right, wow, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. I know that's wrong. My mother, right, lived in a Holocaust world, and I'm not going to tell you crazy stories today on the phone, right, but you know, she lived in a world in which she saw babies ripped apart. Right, how did she know that was wrong? She knew that was wrong because the God in her knew that was wrong. That's the simple understanding. That's wrong. Now, I can't explain why it happens. I can't explain what the love intelligence of all the cosmos was thinking, but I know it's wrong, and that knowing that it's wrong doesn't distance me from the love intelligence of the cosmos. It doesn't distance me, if you will, from God. It makes me closer to God, right? My very anger is intimate. My very anger demands, right, explanation, and I know the explanation's not there. I stay in uncertainty, but that's okay, because the anger itself affirms the dignity, the rightness, the meaning that exists. Right, when I ask, why is there no meaning? Well, it doesn't make any sense. If the world's a flatland, why would there be meaning? The very demand, right, for meaning, right, the very demand for justice is meaning and justice itself. That's second simplicity. Second simplicity says, I stay in the relationship, and I understand that shouting out the question itself, right, is the highest expression of spirit. And I'm going to end with this example of second simplicity, and then we'll open up next minute. My lineage master, Levi Isaac of Berdichev, part of the lineage that I'm in Kabbalah, in the mid-19th century, he actually put God on trial. Now, Levi Isaac of Berdichev is a radical non-dual master. What does it mean he's putting God on trial? What does that mean? He puts God on trial for all the suffering in the world. Does that distance him from God? No. What he's saying is, as an expression of divinity, right, I stand and incarnate justice in the world. And that actually is the impetus of every great social movement. Every good social movement is God in action, right? Is God as a verb living and incarnating through human beings. That's second simplicity. Second simplicity says, how do I respond to Japan? How do I respond to Rwanda? First off, I cry out against injustice. Two is, right, I feel the pain of it as God. Three is, I work to change it in every possible way I can, whether that's by sending relief, whether that's by, you know, creating, you know, better structures for early warning, right, whether that's by helping, right, people who were victimized and helping them rebuild their lives, but I act as God in rebuilding. That's second simplicity. Okay, level one, simplicity, I give an explanation for the suffering. This is why all the terror happened in Japan. That's a New Age response. It's a classical great traditions response. It's a classical response of theodicy. Level two, I don't know the explanation. I can't work it out. Can't figure it out. There probably is no personal divinity, and certainly there's no love intelligence that inheres in the cosmos, because if there would be, right, why would there be all this suffering? That's getting lost in the complexity. I've rejected the first simplicity, but I remain kind of denuded, right, lost in my skepticism, which quickly becomes cynicism. Right, level three, second simplicity. I realize I can't accept the simplicity of first simplicity with its easy theodicies. At the same time, I realized that the flatland world of level two, right, is actually not in, doesn't accord with my own deepest experience through injunction and practice of a world that adheres with love, right, of a world that's actually meaningful and good. So what do? So I affirm, right, I affirm the dignity of the question. I affirm that the question itself is the answer. The question itself doesn't distance me from the divine center, right? It actually creates enormous intimacy with the divine center, second simplicity. So now what we've done is we've showed, right, I hope, right, with a lot of humility and hopefully with some holy audacity, right, as we've all grappled with Japan, right, over the last week and a half, right, how we actually use this framework, right, this of three levels, first, second, third, simplicity, complexity, second simplicity, to actually engage, right, a burning development, right, that just has been before us all the last week and a half, right, which demarcates, right, the world we live in now. This is how we actually use this framework to actually navigate and create a framework of meaning within which we can live and act. Okay. End. So that was 46 minutes. Right, I tried to get us kind of a decade of kind of thinking about this into this 46 minutes to really show you how this works. And so now let's open up for, you know, comments, you know, and questions. You know, usually we'll be weaving with Zach and Clint. They requested before this call that we should on this call just do the kind of let's give the example so you can really see why this framework is so important. And now let's just take any comments and questions from anyone. So anyone, you know, anyone who has a question.
As we're doing that, Marco, I'm just going to remind everybody, just go ahead and hit *6 on your phone, and that will unmute your line. Just go ahead and do that, and then just speak right up.
Yeah, fantastic. Please. And then, of course, you know, Zach and Clinton, Nicole, right, anything from you guys is, of course, obviously completely welcome, even though that wasn't the complete plan for this week. So please, let's take any questions, anyone, any thoughts, any just responses from your heart, from your gut, from your mind.
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi, this is Charles from Ottawa.
Hi, Charles from Ottawa.
Just want to make maybe three very short comments on
Please.
Your question here. Well, it was wonderful, and I really resonate with everything you said. One of the first things is it's amazing these things have been happening to me lately. You mentioned two books, Taylor's and Barrett, William Barrett's book, both of which I've been reading for a long time now.
Wow.
And it's incredible that you highlighted both of these. Actually, the William Barrett book, which is the which is sort of the continental, transatlantic move of existentialism to North America, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been teaching that for 16 years.
Wow, that's fantastic. Isn't that a fantastic book?
It is. It is. It's a wonderful book, and I highly, even written in the 50s, and in spite of it all, it's beautiful. But
That's
to go
right.
to the second point quickly, because probably other
Please.
People would like to talk as well. The notion that you mentioned theory is love as a framework, and you mentioned the word kindness, and all, and I really, really think that is so crucial, and perhaps another quantum leap that we could make. And within kindness, what I would probably emphasize a bit is what I read in the Corpus Hermeticum once, one of the Egyptian wisdom traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And see what you think about this. It's very brief. It says this. It's a bit of a critique of the Greeks. It says this, that the Greeks have empty speeches, O king, that are energetic only in what they demonstrate. And this is the philosophy of the Greeks, an inane philosophy of speeches, he says. We Egyptians, by contrast, use not speeches, but sounds that are full of action. By this is, I think with kindness, we have to pick a tone as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a rhythm. So it really matters that we probe this wonderful concept in all its validity, right? In all
right.
its complexity. So I really would love if, this is probably happening because everybody on the Integral crew is such a wonderful person, But we can push this even more because I think there is a danger of being caught up in a kind of a theoretical, you know, self-sufficiency, which is not the love of theory, which you mentioned, right?
Right.
And the third thing which I'd like to mention, just very briefly, is when you mention second simplicity as cry out the question or hurl the question to God, I can really, really relate to this. And to say that the question is the answer really, really resonates with me. And yet I feel there's something missing there to some extent. Because what I feel is not that the question is the answer, but the question is the is something that goes beyond question and answer. See what I'm saying?
That's right.
So there's a loss of duality with that.
You know, that's Charles. Is this okay? Can I jump in here for a second? Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah, I think, Charles, thank you for all three of your comments. And just to make a very brief observation on your third comment, just because each one of them deserves a world and we don't have quite enough time, but I think you're exactly right. And when I said the question was the answer, that was in a certain sense a transitional comment, meaning I move away from the notion that there's an antinomy or a duality between the question and the answer, which is exactly what you're talking about. It's kind of like in both Buddhism and Kashmir Shaivism and in Kabbalah, you have a realm which is not the dual or the non-dual, it's the dual non-dual, right? So it's this place in which the question and answer, that whole split doesn't exist anymore, right? The question is the answer in to the extent that, right, the question maintains the relationship instead of creates alienation. But the question is never nullified, right, and the answer is never nullified, right? It's not that there's a general, there's a question, then there's an answer. No, actually, the question and answer just kind of live together. The question is the answer is the question, right? And we kind of hold that dialectical dance between the certainty and uncertainty, which I think what you're pointing to, I think that's deeply, deeply correct. Yeah, deeply, deeply correct. Thank you, Charles. Those were all just wonderful comments. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Anyone else?
Mark, I have a question.
Please.
I'm Lawrence. I'm from Texas.
Hey, Lawrence.
And I was wondering.
Ottawa, Texas. We got the continent covered here.
There you go. I was wondering when you were talking about being confused and crying out and feeling the pain and working to change it. I've noticed that I've recently read a bunch of Joseph Campbell, and he points towards the loss of community, which leaves individuals without a direction or without a role or without even a God of some sort. So how can we bring this second simplicity to the community when people who are crying out the question, they don't know who they're crying it out to? So what is our role to help that second simplicity come to the community?
That is, I think I'm sure that Clint and Zach and Nicole just were as delighted, right, as I was by that inquiry, because that really was our intention, right, in creating this course. Right. In other words, let me just make a meta comment and then a specific comment. And here's the meta comment. The loss of community is the loss of the second face of God. The loss of community is the loss of a framework within which we live. And community is an incarnation, an expression, right, of a lived divinity. Right. And so we need to be able to actually engage, right, within that context of community. And one of the things that we need to do in the integral framework, right, is, as Charles says, that it shouldn't be a kind of self-sufficient, right, theorizing, but if theory really is love, it's also got to be love in the second person. And our goal in the second simplicity course is to create a kind of living community within the integral framework that both meets in person, that's on the phone. You know, we meet each other in all these frameworks, and we actually engage as a community, right, in this inquiry, right, in this transmission, and in this shared, right, investigation with all the passion, you know, that's necessary, right? In other words, we've lost, you know, the kind of the ancient mystery schools that engaged in what Paul Tillich called ultimate issues. We need to re-engage ultimate issues, but not as a kind of what, you know, Sartre called a kind of spiritual masturbation, but as kind of poignant, alive issues that engage us and that transform the way we live in the world. And that's precisely the kind of community, right, that we're actually trying to create here, right, right, in the context of second simplicity. So second simplicity, the idea is not just to be a course, right? But to actually be a community, right, that actually engages. Right? And that's exactly the intention, and you're pointing towards it, right? You know, Man from Texas, right, is completely awesome. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Wow, it's I can't believe the time is just about over. It's 5:56. So, Clint, what do you think? Should we just kind of give people a sense of what the possibilities are moving forward at this point? What our possible, you know, unfoldings are?
I'm actually partial to seeing that there's maybe one more question. I love the comments that Charles and Lawrence have offered, and wondering if there's any more. But you know, I can briefly mention just in short that what'll happen next is that we'll send you guys an email that shows you again how to get download access to this call and all the other calls, as well as explains, you know, what the options are for going forward with the course into April and beyond. So rather than taking up too much time now, I'll just get that into an email, most likely come out tomorrow. And then, you know, you can always contact us with any questions.
Fantastic. Thank you.
And one meta comment, not so much on logistics, but just on the point that Mark just made, that, you know, off of what Lauren's brought up, is that, you know, it's so key that we find a way to come together, you know, and whether it's this space, doing these calls, doing this course, mixing it with a live event, whatever we can come up with, we pioneer, you know, this conversation, but it's so radically essential both for the development of ourselves and for the development of ourselves as a culture, because what just keeps ringing out for me in this conversation is recognizing that, you know, outside of this context, you know, I know many of you because I've met you before at events or whatnot, but, like, we interact, you know, on Twitter and on Facebook in, like, 140 characters or less, and the constraints of that sort of emergent communication technology, I think, has, you know, profound effects, both positive and negative, but I'm particularly pointing at the negative right now, that we just don't know how they're going to impact us over the span of 20 years. What will be the impact on the deepening of a discourse, which I think we can argue that, you know, the discourse does need to get deeper and it needs to get wider, and yet the technology is getting shorter and quicker. And so it's another, I guess what I'm saying is when we send out the email, take a moment to open it, take a look, and really contemplate, you know, your important role, you know, in what we're unfolding here.
Yeah. You know, well, Clint, thank you so much. And, you know, really everyone who's listening to this downloaded call, you know, it's been a fantastic three-week course. I think about 180 people signed up, and just it's been just a great experience. We really just, you know, by itself, we've created an artifact, if you will, right, of integral consciousness in these 3 weeks. And now it's really up to everyone, you know, are we going to really, really go forward? If enough people convert to be able to sustain a course, right, at this stage, we'll do it. You know, if not, we'll offer it in some, you know, other format, you know, and Clint will send us the directions from that. And you really just have an incredible group here. I just want to say that, you know, Clint working deeply in theory, you know, Zach working deeply in theory and philosophy, Nicole working from theory, right, to kind of the practicum of integral coaching, right? I mean, just each one of these people are people that you'd want to take 10 courses with. And so really having this kind of weave, you know, and we'll work out how the weave works together, you know, in this kind of larger, you know, meta framework, you know, of the great traditions, you know, of kind of the highest end integral coaching, you know, of the depth of kind of philosophy and all of its expressions of, you know, deep, you know, leading edge integral theory is really just a very special offering. I just don't know of anything like it anyplace in the world. And so I want to invite everyone, you know, really to step forward and create this community together in a way that feels good and gentle and powerful and audacious. You know, let's do it for the sake of the all. You know, for everything in the most, you know, integral evolutionary way we can, even though integral and evolutionary are really the same word, because integral is, right, the evolution of consciousness that we're engaged in together. So that's it. It's 6:00. Thank you very, 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 very much. I would be delighted to stay on the phone for another hour just hearing everyone's comments, because we're just at the beginning of this conversation, but we are at the end of the hour. Thank everyone very, very, very much, and we look forward to seeing you in the next context. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Clint. Thanks, Zach. Thanks, Nicole.
Blessings, everyone.